That's true. Yeah, but Freddy's in the meeting. You never know if... Oh, here they are. Okay. Should I stop?
No.
Sorry? Oh, he's not here. Freddy. Huh? Yeah, but he's busy in the meeting. Someone in there. Thanks for the organizer. Okay, so let me briefly recall the summary so far of yesterday. So, argued that the, well, I shown that loop amplitudes in the quantum field theory can be expressed in terms of phase space integrals of the Ford limit of three amplitudes. So loops are equal to the Hochschild integral of physical three amplitude and the forward limit. And shown that in planar theory this extends to multi-loop level. And also shown that in supersymmetric theories, with SUSY, those physical three amplitudes can be evaluated naively and without any subtlety. So, the forward limit of the three amplitude exists. So today we're gonna try. So the next step is to find a way to use these properties. So today the first thing I will do before I go on giving examples of how to compute scattering amplitude, I will give a simple example of this formula, which, as you will remember, involved retarded boundary conditions. So I give a simple example of an integral with retarded boundary conditions, so you can see the details of how this works. And then I move on to give some n equals 4 example. So let's discuss the simplest possible loop integral we can think of, the bubble integral. Some momentum P incoming, some loop momentum Q, Q plus P, which is just integral
d dq or 2 pi d minus I over q square. Let's consider this integral where phi is some non-null generic external momenta.
So, according to the discussion, so usually we do that with time order boundary condition. So, according to yesterday's discussion, if we do it with retarded boundary condition, we get instead the sum of this guy with a cut here, and this guy with a cut here, and the propagator has to be retarded in both cases. So the formula to check is that this is equal to we put the propagator on shell, so we call this Q again. Here, this diagram, here is a retarded propagator, which is q plus p square minus I epsilon. So I put the I epsilon here, the I epsilon, which I omitted with the standard ones for time order boundary condition. Now I explicitly write them for time order, for retarded conditions. So probably not, just to make explicit. And the second diagram, here, I'm going to say that just to so that it's a simple shift of the other, I'm going to say that Q like this, so that this is Q minus Q. And it's useful to recall my metric convention, which is that P square is minus P0 square, so vector part is most of us. This is the retarded propagator in this signature. So the claim is that this is supposed to lend us any simple analytic continuation of this. So let's compute this and see it. So let's assume for definiteness that P is time-like. Just we have to pick a case. And then it's obvious that all formulas are, in Dirac, they're all finite, everything. They are Lorentz invariant. So we can assume that P only has a P0 component. So the integral d dq over 2 pi d by that the q square, we really just need it as a function of q0. Don't care about the other components. And, well, this is just integral d minus 1 q divided by 2 pi d minus 1. This now is over the vector component, and there's a 1 over 2 q as usual, which is just some, I'm just going to write as a constant, time integral 0 to infinity to dq0 and q0 to d minus. So this is just some numerical prefactor that depends on the dimension, and which is essentially the volume of the unit sphere in d minus 1 dimension. Plus a similar integral with q0 negative. But still this reason, I'm going to make this more explicit. So now this integral we have to do the integral 0 to infinity d q0 d minus 3. And the bracket
becomes 1 over minus p0 squared. So I'm expanding p plus q squared. There's a term that is minus 2 p0 q0, and the q squared term cancel. And there's I epsilon plus p0. I have this term. I have the second term, which is 1 over pretty much the same thing, except it's exactly the same up to reversal of q0. So the two diagrams are exactly the same up to flipping the sign of q as it turns. So with this plus here, I just have to put it to here. So we have to do this integral. Let's assume for definiteness that p0 is greater than 0. To do it explicitly, the answer would be different. This integral is, well, we can pull out, it's useful to pull out a p0 up front of everything. This integral is, well, minus 1 over p0 plus 2 q0. And we see that now this is always positive, so we don't need even to worry about the I epsilon in this term, if we assume that P0 is positive. And then there's another term, which is minus 1 plus P0 minus 2 Q0. And now it's plus I epsilon P0 minus Q0. Divide, yeah. Since p0 is positive, I could divide that by p0, but that doesn't do anything. So this is what I have to do. We see that the I epsilon is only important when q0 is equal to 1 half of p0. And in that case, this object is positive. So we can actually just, what all that matters is the sign of what multiplies the I epsilon, so we can as well just write that. The way we do this integral, sorry? Why do I remove? I wrote the Q0 here because Q0 will always be smaller than P0 when. Yeah, ah, you're right. That's simpler, yeah. Yeah. So this integral. Okay, this integral is completely straightforward, but to do this integral, yeah. But let's first do this one. This one we easily do by rescaling variables. We just do that q0 replace q0, q0, and then the integral just goes to, just by dimension analysis, we get 2 p0 d minus 4 times integral 0 to infinity of some dimensionless integral. Actually, this is a factor of 2 here, and it's probably killed out the 2. Yeah, proper scaling is this, and it's a factor of 2 here. And then, since anyway I haven't worked out the constant here, let's just say that there's another constant prime. I'm not going to worry about this computation. The first time gives you just some number times this. And the second term, well, you will do exactly the same substitution here, except that now the integral is u minus 1. So the way to do this integral is to rotate the contour. So the contour begins life as, if this is the q0 plane, the pole is slightly above the axis. So the way to evaluate this integral is to rotate q0 so that the integral now goes from there to there infinity. When you do this rotation, you end up exactly with the same thing here, except that you have an e to the minus I pi d minus 2. This I can write as d minus 4, so that changes my 2 pi I, but that will make this term look a little more closer to this one.
Is there a...
Yes?
Is there some limit on d? So
yes. As long as d is smaller than 4, you're correct. Which is also the statement that the integral converges. Yeah. This integral is derived at divergence. And we have to assume that d was smaller than 4. With this condition, this is allowed. Okay. Now we can go back here. And see that this is equal to some constant times, this is just some number, times t0 to the t minus 4 times t to the times 1 plus t to the minus I by t minus
4. So we're going to try to put this into a more useful form. This, it is useful to write as this factor. Useful to write as e to the minus I pi d minus 4 over 2 times twice some cosine of, just to pull out the overall phase of this object. Ultimately, the overall phase will be included into this factor. So some cosine of pi d minus 4 over 2. I can just absorb this cosine into some extra constant. I'm just going to focus on the dependence on t0. What I get is, and I'm going to move forward by writing this at t0 square, d minus 4 over 2, times e to the minus I pi, d minus 4 over 2. Which we recognize as nothing but minus p0 square minus I epsilon to the d minus 4 over 2. If this I epsilon is understood as a prescription to evaluate this, the minus sign here along the right phase, it fixes the sign of the phase with this minus sign. And now, at this stage, it is clear what we will have obtained if we use any other time-like vector with positive imaginary part. We will have obtained simply p square. But this time, it's clear how to make a Lorentz invariant out of that. Now, this is correct when p0 is positive. What happens when p0 flips sign? Well, it's easy to see that the answer gets complex, becomes simply its complex conjugate.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. So the equation that makes complex conjugation theorist is probably the original one. Yeah. So in this form, we're instructed to include both the positive and negative frequency part of Q. And if we flip P, then you see that those two terms are the same up to reversal of Q. And if we flip P, we make P goes to minus P, Q goes to minus Q. Sorry, this is not. Yeah.
you just make p goes to minus p, those two terms get exchanged, except that q0, except that the sign of this term gets opposite. So this goes to q0 minus p0, which is the opposite of that. So if we flip the sign of p, we just get the complex conjugate, which tells us that actually the correct I epsilon here is I epsilon p0. So if you write that, we get the correct imaginary part in all time-like regions. And the next thing to check is that this object naturally suggests that in the space-like region, we should have just p squared to the d minus 4 over 2. Which will require a third separate computation a priori. But I will not do it here. But one thing we can check is that when p is space-like, the answer is indeed real. Fine. Not going to check the constant from, but just the fact that it's real is a non-trivial check. How do we see that this is real when p is space-like? Let's just see that p is equal to just some pz component. Then the imaginary part of this object, you have to replace this by a delta function. So the imaginary part, let's go here. The imaginary part of the integral, with two integral of one term is this, pi delta of q plus p square, and then there's a sign of q0 plus p0. That's what the imaginary part is. Now, what we're going to see immediately is that whenever we have a solution for this, if p is along just this z direction, then, well, first of all, this sign here just becomes sign of q0 because p0 is 0. And we see that whenever we have a solution, say q vector q, we also have a solution minus q0 vector q with the opposite sign. And since the integral is convergent in Dirac, everything is nice, those two just cancel each other, and we get 0. So each of those terms integrate to 0 for the imaginary part when p is space-like. So what we've shown is that this expression on top is the correct answer in all kinematics, up to the normalization which we haven't checked, but which I assure you. So this is to be checked compared with the answer we will have obtained with time order boundary condition, which is nothing but some constant times p square to the d minus 4, or p square minus I epsilon to the d minus 4 over 2. So it is really trivial to go from one to the other. And in fact, when p is space-like, there's nothing to say, they're just plain equal. Yeah, so as expected, we just have the same function evaluated in two different branches. Yeah, and there's no need to evaluate diagrams with double cuts to get this analytic function. So, yeah, this bubble integral, someone might complain it's a little too trivial because it's a very simple analytic function of the answer. So in the paper, I've worked out some triangle and some less trivial, which has some less trivial analytic dependence. The same works out. Yeah. So, there are any questions? I can answer them now. If not, I'm going to move on to discuss the how to calculate planar. How to calculate scattering amplitude using that. Yeah.
It's different by epsilon. They are different functions. Analytic continuation means you start in some region, you move smoothly, and you arrive at the other region.
Yeah. So you're saying that. Okay. So let's see how those two functions are analytic continuation of each other. But if we don't put the I epsilon or anything, just look at the function p square minus 4 over 2. You would say the function of p0 at x p square. We can plot it in various ways. If you plot it like this, then there's a point here, and there's a point here, where this object becomes null. So if you are on this green line here, the object is space-like, and here it's literally for the p squared minus 4 over 2 without any. So in this region here, it's a completely unambiguous function. And this function has branch cuts along its axis when you are not in integer dimension. So this function here is obtained by going all the way to the upper side of the branch cut. Because in this function you can think of as a function, you can write this function as p0 plus I epsilon squared minus p squared. So you're always slightly above the p0 axis. So this notation is a shorthand for this analytic function, but evaluated slightly above the real axis when you are interested in real Minkowski physics. Whereas this notation is a shorthand for exactly the same function, but evaluated here and here, as usual for a time order function. So they're really the same function, except that on the negative axis, you're on a different side of the branch cut. But the analytic continuation just says that you should go here around this branch cut and go up.
Do the final tree theorem, then all I do is take my timing propagators and replace it by instantly retarded, and that's delta function, and I can prove it all at the level of the integral.
Yeah.
But I end up with double caps, etc.
Yeah.
Presumably there's a similar thing you could have done here, just at the level of the integral.
Oh, literally. So there's the difference between the two answers is this branch cut.
Yeah.
And if we would have done the final tree theorem, as you said, we would have gotten an actual diagram that probably look like a double cut propagator. Probably it would have needed to have both propagators negative.
So if I take the answer that you got from your retarded guy plus cut, times cut, then is that just the answer I would have got from the original integral using retarded boundary conditions everywhere?
Well, I don't know what it would mean to evaluate this with retarded boundary condition. You see? Oh, no, yeah, no, sorry, yeah, it means something about the, where you put the contour, So we could have done this integral. If we put a little imaginary part to p0, if we do this integral, so if these are the poles, let me use color, like this. If this is a pair of poles on the propagator, this is the q0 axis. This is a pair of poles from the propagator q squared, and this is a pair of poles from the other propagator. then the retarded condition corresponds to taking the contour that is sandwiched between the two. So below this and above this. So yeah, if you did this integral, the retarded boundary condition, which means to do this integral, you will have obtained the answer.
Right, so then it does look like if I that we could have done this calculation just at the level of the integrand.
Well, this is a calculation of the level of integrand. I just replaced two of them by the other function.
You then evaluated those integrals and showed that you got the same thing as evaluating the original integral. Like, is there some sort of, not algebraic, but some sort of identity you would have used on the functions? And if you've manipulated the integral, the integrands themselves, so it's obvious that it's just as you do with finite functions, but using retarded boundary condition.
As far as I know, not really, because there's a formalism where all this becomes algebraic. But you need to double the field. There's a Schmier-Kedrish formalism with double fields. So I think to make this manipulation algebraic, you have to use this formalism. I can tell you more after the talk. But with just single field propagator, I don't think that can work. But yeah, there's a way to make all these manipulations algebraic. Okay, let me now move on to the compute 4-point scattering amplitude that it was for.
Compute some MHV 4-point amplitude at one loop in n equals 4. I choose n equals 4 because this is going to be simple enough that I can do it on a blackboard, which I wouldn't be able to with less symmetry. But in principle, it should be possible to do this in n equals 4. I'll do this as not nearly done in a little bit. So roughly the plan, the way I'm gonna do it, so we have to calculate the single cuts. The single cuts are going to be, so we're supposed to add two particles. In this other original one you have, I'm gonna add two particles in the four limit. And these particles have opposite elasticity. So this is elasticity h, this is elasticity h, this is minus h, and I sum over elasticities with the minus sign for the fermions. So this is the forward free amplitude we need. And you see, because the elasticities are opposite here, it's going to be, we need NMHV 6-point. Amplitude. We're in luck because this is something that is well understood and can be found in the literature, so we don't actually have anything to compute. Yeah. And then we're going to compute the single cuts in our color channels to get the full answer. So, are we going to compute this 6-point amplitude? Well, there are many ways to proceed. We could use the answer in the literature. Most of the nice compact answers are obtained using DCFW. So I'm just going to use directly DCFW here. For the fermion? Yeah, but
you have a tree now, so why do you have it? I thought it's a loop factor you put in the diagram,
yeah.
But you don't have it there.
Yeah, but this comes from opening a loop.
So it's about distance space?
Yeah. There's a heuristic way, yeah. Yeah, it's still states, yeah. Fermions come to the minus, yeah. You have to put this by hand.
So we're going to use DCFW, and actually the simplest DCFW that for this problem is we're going to use the one along that shifts Q and minus Q. So yeah, that shifts the adjacent DCFW that involves those two lines. This is a slightly singular version of DCFW, but we're going to do it by just, we're going to first assume that Q prime is not exactly equal to minus Q, and then we're going to take the forward limit. Yeah. We do this DCFW shift. So an equation that means, let's do lambda Q prime goes to, the deformation is lambda Q prime equal to lambda Q prime plus Z lambda Q, and lambda bar Q, the form equal to lambda bar Q minus Z lambda bar Q prime. And now there are various ellipses here, plus, minus, minus, plus. We have to make sure the deformation vanishes to infinity. And the way we do that, we're going to use the supersymmetric deformation. So that error of Q is the form 2 minus Z error Q prime. So let me explain the notation a little bit more. Most of you are familiar with it, but it's good to we'll just take a minute. The supermultiplet, I use the expansion, and the supermultiplet is equal to plus gluon plus eta. This is a state. So the firm, so eta A as A runs from 1 to 4. The eta's are anti-commuting variables such that, yeah, and these are the 4 fermion states of the theory, the 4 gauge genos, and then some eta A, eta B over 2 times scalar field plus eta A, eta B, eta C. So the whole supermultiplet of states is unified. A similar function was in James' talk this morning. And in this notation, the tree amplitude becomes simply for the four point tree amplitude is simply delta 8 of sum of lambda eta. And the lambdas are such that pi, which you can write pi alpha alpha dot, which is the usual transition between spinor indices and vector indices, is equal to lambda alpha lambda bar alpha dot. With this notation, and this is the true product of the lambdas, the amplitude becomes simply that. And what this means, for instance, is if we want to consider the plus plus minus minus amplitude, this is an example, then we want to extract the component of this object, which is proportional to eta tree. This is a power series in the eta's. We want to extract the object that's proportional to eta tree to the fourth eta form, according to this wave function. And when we extract this component, this is the 8 here. Let's just look at, so there are 4 indices on this guy and 2 indices on this guy. We just take 1 here. Only the factors 3 and 4 are going to matter. So there's lambda 3, eta 4, plus lambda 4, eta 4 for all. This is a product for all R symmetry index.
this delta function. This it's a two delta function for the spinor index of lambda. And because these guys are anti-symmetrical, we end up with nothing but the anti-symmetrical product of the lambdas, which is equal to 3, 4, eta 3, eta 4. So if you want to extract this component, just extract the component proportional to this to the fourth, which is equal to 3, 4 square over 1, 2. So this notation allows us to package all the amplitude in a very compact way. So this to the fourth power, yeah. So eta, the eta's are,
yeah, so this would be the same A. So A
for
one.
Given A.
Yeah, for given, for each A that is this, yeah.
So I'm going to use this deformation. I get three BCFW terms a priori. There's the one that fits. 2, 3, 4, Q. There's another one which is just reversed, and there's the one that is like this. I'm going to argue. We're going to see very quickly that those two BCFW diagrams are actually zero, which is why this deformation is particularly useful for this problem. Well, they vanish, more precise statements that they vanish in the forward limit.
Independent of your choice of lambda Q prime?
Yes. Yes. Oh, it's very easy to see. Yeah. Yes. So, yeah. For this term, actually, it's going to be really obvious because this term is really not singular in the forward limit. So those two terms, let's do them carefully.
Then we're going to, in this example, we'll be able to see why the, in concretely, what does it mean that the forward limit is well defined in theory. So I'm deforming the lambdas of Q. Let me pause for a second. Let me keep this and just change the labels A, just so that it will be simpler to manage. So with this deformation, the deformation parameter is Z. We need to solve for Z0 when, so yeah, so Q at P1 plus, yeah, so this deformation Z0 is obtained by solving for this propagator to be 0, and this propagator is nothing but lambda Q times lambda bar Q minus Z0 lambda bar Q prime. And the solution to that, since both of these are null vectors, is simply that Q1 minus Z0 Q prime 1 equal to 0, or put differently, Z0 is equal to Q prime Q1 over Q prime 1. So in the forward limit, Z0 just goes to 1.
So amplitudes, on this side we have MHV amplitudes, and all the angle brackets are zero. So the amplitude is simply, let's call this particle in the middle M. So there's an integral over the index of this part of the, so this does the sum over states, and we need to do an integral over error Q. On the left hand side we have a Suzy factor that's delta 8 lambda 1 error 1 plus lambda m error m plus lambda q, and then this is error q minus v0 error q prime. And there's another factor, delta 8, lambda 2 out of 2, lambda 3 out of 3, lambda 4 out of 4, plus lambda q prime z0, lambda q eta q prime. And this is multiplied by some big denominator. So let me go to the point. What do we have? The forward limit is when lambda q goes to minus lambda q prime, lambda bar q goes to lambda bar q prime, and eta q goes to eta q prime, and z0 goes to 1. So in the forward limit, this object vanishes linearly. This object also vanishes linearly as you approach it. And this denominator here, so this is completely regular, but q prime is really lambda q minus z0, sorry, z0 lambda q, which goes to zero. So in the forward limit, if we take the difference generically to the forward limit to be order epsilon, the denominator is order epsilon squared from this term and this term. And the numerator is a delta 4 here. And the delta 4, because of this integral, bring us epsilon to the fourth at the forward limit, epsilon goes to zero. So the reason we get a fourth is this is really very close to zero, this is very close to zero, and we're integrating over, we are forced to extract one of these components. So in the forward limit, these diagrams vanish very, very fast, and there's absolutely no reason to worry about them. We just have to look at this one. And this one in the forward limit is going to be completely smooth because the value of the deformation parameter where this is obtained by setting this on shell is at some completely random point that's not close to zero or one or infinity or anything. So it's a completely random point, and this diagram we see that we can just put go straight to the forward limit. So this single diagram, which we're going to evaluate, if we're on the forward limit, the deformation becomes very, very, simplifies a lot. So let's just say that we're really in the forward limit. So then this we can see that this is equal to lambda q 1 minus z, and this is lambda bar q. So the deformation is just a rescaling of the variable. So let's introduce a variable w that's equal to 1 minus z to simplify our lives. So we have to solve for what is w0 here. And the condition to solve is that p1 plus p2 plus w0 q square is 0. Oh, let me switch notation. This solution, as promised, it's some completely generic point, non-singular. So we have to evaluate the amplitude on the left, on the right. As we see, it's just a 4-point MHV amplitude on each side. So we have to evaluate, let's call this guy M as before. Evaluate this. And downstairs, there's a 1, 2, 2M. M, Q, Q1, and on the other side, there is Q4, 4Q, but the lambdas were scaled on this side, so there's a omega 0, W0 from this, and there's a QM, which is also proportional to lambda Q, so this gets squared, and there is finally M3. And up to the usual, there's A, number 1, error 1, number 2, error 2, minus Z0, Z0, number N. And then there's a minus sign. The important point in this equation is that there's a minus sign between this and this, which is because momenta are opposite. And what this minus sign tells us is that actually this delta, this we can write as a delta function of lambda 1, lambda 1, plus lambda 2, lambda 2, plus lambda 3, lambda 3, plus lambda 4, lambda 4. Which is just, so we're going to pull, so this allows us to just pull out the MHV 3 amplitude. So as expected, SUSY is conserved in a trivial way. So we can pull out this factor. Then there's a 1, 2, there's a 3, 4 here. And it's useful to pull out the full MHV amplitude. So we have to write, reinstate 2, 3, 4, 1. And then downstairs we just have Q1, Q3. Yeah. Oh, one thing, there's a zero, this is not Z0, this is W0. So, just as on the other side, there's a 1 over W0 squared downstairs and a W squared, W to the fourth upstairs. There's a W squared here. And then there's the M2. Sorry, this is 2,4. And this integral brings contraction of A lambda Q lambda M to the fourth, which is there twice the numerator of this square. So that's the formula. And just to check, we can see that all the little group indices nicely cancel again. So this is, we've not forgotten any factor. So let's just evaluate this. So what is the spinor M M is a spinor here, we can write simply as Q times Q plus M is the spinor associated with WQ plus 1 plus 2. But if we write it in this form, this cancels, so M is really P1 plus P2. That's what M is. So this form and W0. Oh, I missed factor. Sorry. As usual in BCFW, I need to multiply by 1 over Q plus Q1 plus Q2 for the exchange propagator. So let's evaluate this. The QM square here just becomes Q dot P1 plus P2 square, which cancel against this. Numerator is really just P1 dot P2 square. 2341 divided by Q1, Q4. What is M2? M2 is simply, so the P2 cancel, that's simply Q1, 1, no, sorry. I'm sorry, I made a typo when I wrote, so this is an angle bracket, so that this is usual for vector dot into an angle bracket to give you into square bracket to give you an angle bracket. So this is Q1, 1, 2. And similarly, M3 is nothing but Q, P3 plus P4, the minus sign dotted into 3, which is equal to minus Q4, P4. So this equation you see, yeah, that's right. So this expression just becomes Q1, Q4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So we arrive at the conclusion. We can finally write that down as 1 over, so those two factors are just Q dot P1, Q dot P4, Q plus P1 plus P2 square times these factors. These factors don't have any overall little group indices, so they're just products of S, Mandelstam S and T. And easy to see, so this is S-like, this is S-like, this is T-like, so the numerator is really just S, which is, you can do this more in more steps, but it's just S. So, what do we find? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, so, yeah.
You were advocating it so much and they haven't seen that you used it.
No, so far it's not used. Yeah.
No, but when you cut your diagram, you still had a lot of propagators, but somehow
yes.
You ignored that fact and just wrote immediately as a product of two image geometries, right?
Yes, so at this stage here, we can just put we recognize that there's a family of denominators, and we can just put the correct I epsilons here. For the intermediate steps, there was nothing special about retarded time
over.
So
the diary tells me at the final step that you first do manipulations and then you recall that I should be retarded. I'm just understanding the description.
Yeah, so you just have to put that back in when you actually do the integral.
So over Q, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. The algebra is completely.
Now you have Q times P1, how will you put your epsilon here?
Yeah, so since at this stage that we have to do a little interpretation, which is actually no one, well, let's put it that way. There's actually no epsilon here because this product is never zero in 3,1 signature.
You were in 2,2?
No, we know, everything is in 3,1. So this, if you have two like null vectors, then this dot product is basically the norm of the two times an angle. And it's never, it gets close to zero in collinear limits, but it's never really zero. So there's no need to put an I epsilon.
But Q was not a null
vector. Yes, Q is a null vector. But computed the...
Oh, when you got to say that it's on the shell.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So we found, so far we have a term in the full answer, which is equal to this. Integral of Q on shell times ST over Q plus P1 plus P2 squared. And this factor, just Q dot P1, it's useful to rewrite it as Q plus P1 squared. So this is an equality when they are, because they are both none. And the other one, just for sake of, just because we can, let's write it like this, because that's more illuminating. So we have this term in the answer. And in this, yeah, in this form, everything is supposed to be retarded. So there are two things we can do here, like once we have this answer. One of them is to actually do this integral using retarded operators and everything, as I said, and it's divergent in the interval, but we can regulate it just by doing here in D dimension. And because it's a one-loop integral and it's just infinite divergent, knowing the integral in 4D is enough. This is something that has been understood since the first days of Bern, Dixon, and Cassaver in 94, I guess. When if all the divergences are infrared, then in principle, if you work this out carefully in D dimension, you will have so-called new track of scales. But if all the divergences are infrared, this makes integral infrared finite, and never multiplies epsilon over epsilon. So this is just order epsilon, and you don't care. So you don't need the new term at one loop for anything like that, and you just have to take that and integrate it in the dimensions, and fine.
So if I stick in four dimensions to that,
yeah.
Three, I suppose. Yeah. But I keep the I epsilon is there, and I think of epsilon as finite.
And I guess you're going to get an answer.
Is that a finite epsilon that should be regularized?
I think the I epsilons are finite or finite. Well, yeah. That gives a mass scale to your option.
Okay.
Yeah. So we could do it. But so far the technology for doing these integrals directly is not well developed. So the better way to do them, the most efficient way known so far to do these integrals is to go back, is to do loop integrals, is to use finite parameters in the ordinary Euclidean formulation. So we can try to go back from, so what I'm going to do next, I'm going to show that we can go back from this expression and reconstruct what the off-shell loop integral was in the first place. So effectively, I'm using this trick as a way to efficiently do the numerical algebra. So if we have this formula, and of course when we have the other guy, with the three amplitude applying this, then of course when we do the other shots, this get sick. We have four terms for four channels. What you can do at this stage is just recognize that this is a Feynman tree theorem applied to this sum is a mathematical identity, this sum is equal to times integral of minus I st q squared q plus p1 plus p2 squared q plus p1 minus p4. With mathematical identity that this sum is equal to this one. And now we can do this with the integral in this form. I will not do it here, but it's a standard integral. Well, it's just the massless scalar integral. Mm.
The claim is that these, if everything's retarded, these two things are the same.
Yeah. And then you can do, once you have written this with a red here, it's trivial to do the analytic continuation. You just erase red and write T. Yeah. So the bottom line is, so the way to look at this computation, say we've computed all single cuts of the answer of the integrand, and from the single cuts of the integrand, we've reconstructed what the full integrand was.
Is it always obvious how to do that last step?
No. So the general strategy we will do is the, so I did a 5-point example in the paper, but the general strategy is from this step here alone. I just give you, so suppose I don't have the cyclic sum. Suppose I just have this term here. What does it teach us? This term tells you that, so obviously this term is the single cut of this. So that tells you that the full answer is equal to this. So if you just knew this, you know that the answer is equal to this plus some possible integral over, again, the same numerator, because that's the most general denominator you can get, plus something that doesn't have a... So the most general thing you could be missing from the single cut is a term that has, that doesn't have a q squared O. So just this term alone determines the answer up to a term like that. And then you do you can do the same thing for the next gap here. And you figure that this q squared times f is also equal to q plus p1 squared times another function g of q. Right? Yes. From this you deduce that actually the only thing you could have missed of these two single cuts is something proportional to both q squared and q plus p1 squared. Or more. Yeah. So you can only be missing q squared plus p1 squared and another denominator. This is all the only function that don't have residues on this pole, on those two poles. So geometrically, this allows you to, this term allows you to fix the answer of modulo triangles. And the other term allows you to restrict that the triangle actually is the model at most. Massless bubble, very, very specific, and then the, well, you do it in one more channel, and you're done. You've shown that the answer can be anything but a tadpole, and then you do the fourth channel, and you find the answer uniquely. So if you know the single cuts in all channels, all color channels, then you can uniquely construct it. So it's a so just like the unit arithmetic cut method, it's a linear algebra problem. So you have to write down an ansatz and match all single cuts. Yeah. conclude this lecture with the conclusions that so yesterday we figured out that the single cuts determine the answer, but now we actually know that the single cuts can be used algorithmically to determine the integral in the first place. So effectively we've developed numerical algebra. So the next lecture will be Friday at 2 o'clock, and then what I will discuss is a more efficient way to use exactly the same data. We know that the single cuts uniquely determine the answer. So how do we most efficiently use this data to construct the answer? And Friday we're going to introduce a recursion relation that builds upon this data and that spits the answer in completely explicit closed form. So there's no longer any need to do this in your algebra step. You see a further before the integral. So thank you. That's all for today.